And if you go into an academic course on Buddhism, pretty quickly you learn about Four Noble Truths. However, if you went to see the Buddha, he might not start with the Four Noble Truths. He'd work to sort of get your mind prepared for seeing why the Four Noble Truths were valuable. And it was through this graduated discourse. First, he gave a talk on giving and how, you know, the virtues of giving and how enjoyable it is and how good it is. Then he would talk about virtue. He would talk about the precepts. Then he would talk about heaven as how this is where the generosity and virtue take you. But then he would talk about the drawbacks, degradation, defilement of sensuality. Because a lot of the attraction of heaven is that the sensual pleasures are pretty intense. But so even in heaven, though, there's an end to the sensual pleasures. And when you fall from the deva world, you tend to fall hard. My teacher had a couple of students who were extremely difficult people, almost impossible to please. And one time he made the comment, you know, there were devas in a previous lifetime. The human world is just not good enough. And so once you begin to see that sensuality does have its drawbacks, then he would talk about the rewards of renunciation, that was going beyond sensuality. One of the more famous instances of this in the canon is the monk who had been a king prior to becoming a monk, and one day he's sounded in a tree saying, "What bliss, what bliss." And the other monks are concerned. They say he's probably thinking about his time back as a king, missing his pleasures. So they report this matter to the Buddha. The Buddha calls the monk in and says, "What were you thinking about when you said, 'What bliss, what bliss'?" And the monk says, "Back when I was a king, even though I had all these pleasures, I had to have guards stationed inside the palace and outside the palace and inside the city and outside the city, inside the countryside, outside the countryside. And even then, I couldn't sleep well. But now I go under a tree. I live, my needs are as simple as those of a deer. And they're all met. And so that's what I'm thinking about now. What bliss, what bliss." Those are the joys of renunciation. Nobody's jealous of what you got. And then finally, once you see that renunciation would be a good thing, then he would teach you the Four Noble Truths. So what he's giving you here is karmic reasons for why you want to switch from mundane right view to being receptive to the Four Noble Truths. And that takes us into noble right view. Four Noble Truths, suffering, its origination, its cessation, and the path to its cessation. And notice that the fact that the Buddha is focusing on this as the primary problem in life, it's the suffering you're causing yourself. So it's not just four facts or an interesting framework for looking at experience, but it's a question of priorities. What's important? What are the big issues that have to be resolved? And the big one is your clinging and your craving. And as we said earlier, there are a lot of questions he does not answer in terms of Four Noble Truths. He puts aside questions about the world and about the nature of the self, because those are more related to mundane right view. Here is having you look at things simply as activities and their results. Each of the four categories carries a duty, which we've already discussed. What's not in the reading is when the Buddha teaches also as an expansion on the Four Noble Truths, he gets into dependent core arising, which is basically a way of fleshing out the second and third Noble Truth, i.e. expanding, explaining how the various stages leading up to craving and then on through suffering, and then how you can put an end to them by bringing knowledge to any one of those links, seeing those each link in terms of the Four Noble Truths, and by taking apart a particular link, the effects can spread throughout the rest of the system. What's important about that, for our terms, is that this is where he introduces the teaching on the three fabrications that we've been talking about, bodily, verbal, and mental. And in the analysis there, if these things are done through ignorance, they're going to lead to suffering. But if you bring knowledge to them, they can become the path to the end of suffering. Because they are fabrications, they'll eventually have to be abandoned when they've done their work. But until they've done their work, you hold on to them. So that's noble right view. And then moving from noble to ultimate right view, there's a passage in here where Ananda Bendika is talking to a group of sectarians. And he basically points out the fact that noble right view looks at things in terms of actions and the suffering that comes from holding on to views. And after it's looked at other views and is able to pry your interest away from those views, then it has the ability to turn on itself and say, well, this too is a view. This too is a fabrication. If I cling to it, it's going to lead to suffering. And then you let it go. But notice you don't let it go until it's done its other work. So there's a lot of talk about saying, well, I have no fixed views. And you say, well, if you have no fixed views, then your views haven't been fixed. You've got to fix your views first, and then you can let them go. So you do hold on. It's like the raft. You hold on to the raft while you're crossing over, and you let it go only at the end. But that's how noble right view has the sort of the seeds for its own transcendence to lead to what becomes what we call ultimate right view, which is that everything that arises you regard it as stress, and there's only one duty, which is dispassion, letting go. And it's when you get to that stage, then you're on the verge of awakening. Any questions about noble right view?
John, so there's a mundane right view, which is the Four Noble Truths. Karma, cause and effect. Then there's super mundane, which is seeing everything in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And then is the third one transcendent?
The second one would be transcendent, but the third one would be kind of the ultimate version of transcendent right view.
And that's where all Four Noble Truths...
They come together.
Okay. So, but transcendent is super mundane, same thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right, thank you.
Yes.
I'm just lost about what page we're on.
We're not on the readings. I'm giving you a general introduction, then we go through the readings. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. No. I would just want to give you an overview of the topic, and then we can go into the details. Okay. One other question I want to touch on before we go into the readings. There's sometimes the question of what is the relationship of the three perceptions or the three characteristics to right view? When I was working on the book On the Path, I was reading other people's books on the path, and I was amazed at how many times right view was equated with seeing things in terms of the three characteristics. The implication being that we suffer because we don't see things as they actually are, and what we don't see is that there is no self, and if we saw that there was no self, then we wouldn't suffer, which is awfully simplistic. It's like saying, food is impermanent, my stomach is impermanent, so I will not eat. You're going to be eating anyhow, and so you might as well you have to learn how to eat skillfully first before you get beyond the need to eat. And when you look at the way the Buddha discusses these, and he actually never uses the word three perceptions. He talks about them. Excuse me, he doesn't talk about them as three characteristics. They're three perceptions that you apply to your experience for the purpose of giving rise to dispassion. And they are basically tools that you use to implement the duties of the Four Noble Truths. So, for instance, with the First Noble Truth, this is what you analyze to see, okay, that the clinging that you have and the things that you're clinging to are all inconstant. And even if you're clinging to something constant, the clinging itself is an inconstant activity. It's going to be stressful, and therefore, should you regard it as yourself? Is it worth regarding as yourself? And the answer is no. Now notice the question there. The Buddha didn't say things are inconstant, therefore stressful, therefore there is no self. He never says that. They're inconstant, stressful, then it's not worth clinging to them, not worth holding on. It's a value judgment that you're making there. That's a point that has to be stressed again and again, because a couple months ago I was being interviewed in France on a TV show that's devoted to Buddhism. And this was the issue that we were talking about. And I said, the Buddha has this questionnaire where he says, is this stressful or is it, constant or inconstant? It's inconstant. If it's inconstant, is it stressful or easeful? It's stressful. And I said, then the Buddha does not come to the conclusion that there is no self. He comes to the conclusion that it's not worth holding on to. And then a month later, when it was broadcast and we saw it on YouTube, they found out the interpreter had said, the Buddha comes to the conclusion there is no self. I mean, it's so ingrained in the Buddhist mind that you have to keep chipping away at it. Say, no, the Buddha never said there is no self. In fact, that question, is there a self, is there no self, it was one he put aside. So, on the mundane level, you're told to view karma as your own and other things of lesser importance, and so you would see those other things as and constant stressful not self. There's a passage where the Buddha says there are five kinds of loss. There's loss of relatives, loss of wealth, loss of health, loss of virtue, and loss in views. He says, oh, those five, only two are really serious, loss of virtue and loss of views. Loss of your relatives, loss of your health, loss of your wealth are not serious issues, or not nearly as issue as these other two. It's very different from most people's attitude. And where this comes, you know, where it becomes an important issue is when you feel tempted to break the precepts for the sake of your wealth or for the sake of your relatives or for the sake of your health. He said you would do much better to be willing to sacrifice those three things for the sake of your virtue. And so when you have to regard them as inconstant, stressful, not self. So that's where you would apply those three perceptions on the mundane level. In terms of the duties of the Four Noble Truths, you see stress as inconstant, stressful, not self. You see clinging as inconstant, stressful, not self. As for the path, when you are developing concentration, you have to use these three perceptions against any distractions, anything that would pull you away from the concentration. You're thinking about tonight's dinner. No, those thoughts are inconstant, stressful, not self. You can leave them alone. Focus on the concentration. But you do not look at the concentration yet as inconstant, stressful, and not self. In fact, actually, while you're developing concentration, you're trying to make it constant, easeful, and under your control. You're kind of basically fighting against those three characteristics to see how far you can go with the process of fabrication. And it's only on the ultimate level that you learn to look at everything, including concentration and including discernment, as something worth letting go. Remember, discernment too is a fabrication. Okay. So, any questions on those three perceptions? Yes.
The clarity with which you describe it, especially about the meaning of where self applies and it doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. I've been studying meditation for almost 40 years. Mm-hmm. It was one of the things that was a big barrier for me to actually understand the teaching. Mm-hmm. Why is there such a huge gap within the Buddhist community about that definition, because it is a significant barrier to understanding the teaching?
I think it goes back to two things. One, self and not the question of the existence or not existence of the self was one the Buddha said to put aside. Quite a few other issues he said to put aside. He also told the monks, don't get involved in formal debates. Because formal debates back in those times, particularly in India, were basically organized by kings and other rulers, and they wanted to hear the different sectarians argue their case. And sometimes it would be on the basis of who won the debate that the king would decide who he wanted to support. But the Buddha said, stay away from those debates, because you can't say, you know, this is a stupid question, this is a question that should be put aside. That's an insult to the king. And so you're, by entering into the debate, you're submitting to whatever questions are posed at you. And the Buddha was in a different position. People would come to him and say, you know, tell us about the world, tell us about this. And he said, no, put those aside. And these are the reasons we put it aside. But if you're in a formal debate, you're not in that position. However, the monks could not resist the temptation to win the support of the kings. And so they submitted to these debates. And one of the debates topics that kept coming up again and again was, is there a self? What is the self? And so they were pressed on this, and they finally came to the conclusion there is no self. And that from that point on, Buddhist philosophy just kind of went off in that direction. And it's in all the schools. It's Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. They differ as to, you know, they'll give what the Buddha would call an analytical answer to the question. You know, there is no permanent self, but there is a temporary self. Or your aggregates are really what you are, but just not really a self. Or there's no separate self, but there's a connected self. Another analytical answer. But the Buddha said, this is the question, you just put it aside. It's not worth answering anyway at all. So that's as far as I can see where that problem came from.
Well, I'd like to thank you for the clarity, well, thank sincerely.
You. Thank you. You're welcome. Yeah. Any other questions? Anyone who would not like to thank me? Yes, in the back.
Are we still talking about the white wheel?
Yes.
Okay, good, good. I was just thinking, thank you, agent, for coming to Victoria, first of all. I think we're all very appreciative of your coming here. And secondly, I was thinking, if we can like graphically kind of talk about this. We see this gentleman here. I think he's a man. So, and then he has all his weapons with him. I was just thinking about it during the break. Mm-hmm. Like, if his will is correct that that there's no harm or no violence, and that it doesn't really matter what he holds into his hand, he's going to be okay, then he wouldn't have the stress of holding those weapons with him. Mm-hmm. So it's something that he fabricated, like it's not real, it's not true.
Well, it's his issue, suppose that he has some feelings, is he's got something he's got to defend.
Well, not in this university, mm-hmm. I don't think. Mm-hmm.
Then I don't understand your question.
Oh, okay. I get what you mean. So if he's trying to defend himself, mm-hmm. it would be more appropriate than if he were not to defend himself, is that?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's got the weapons because he feels there's something he needs to defend himself against.
But then isn't it something that he kind of, maybe something from his previous experience or his karma?
Okay, well, suppose that he's doing battle with his defilements, okay? He's going to need the sword and he's going to need the shield.
Oh, so true. Yeah. Well, thank you. I think I got it now.
But then when he doesn't need to have any more defilements to battle, then you got to put him down.
Oh, so that goes.
Okay. Right.
Thank you.
Okay, let's look at some of the passages. Passage number 9 on page 5. This is a case where the Buddha is talking to a householder who was originally a follower of the Jains. And they have a long discussion, and the Buddha wins them over. And so then he gives a graduated talk to a Bali, a talk on giving, a talk on virtue, a talk on heaven. He proclaims the drawbacks, degradation, and defilement of sensuality, and the rewards of renunciation. And then when he knew that Ubali, the householder, was of ready mind, malleable mind, unhindered mind, exultant mind, confident mind, he proclaimed to him the distinctive teaching of the Buddhists, stress, origination, cessation, path, i.e. the Four Noble Truths. So it's basically getting you ready to see that this is a useful teaching, and to look at yourself in those four terms, or look at your activities in those four terms. It's basically to wean you off the idea that you want to have a nice rebirth, or that you're perfectly content to stay embedded in sensuality. What's interesting is you look at the canon. I was doing an anthology one time, and I wanted to give examples of all these different topics. There's very little on heaven. There's only one passage where the Buddha says, imagine a king with all the possible powers and joys of a king, and that's only a fraction of the pleasures of heaven. But he doesn't go into descriptions of what those heavenly pleasures are. There's a lot on hell. Two very graphic suttas that, you know, for people who go for that kind of thing can really get into. One of the monks at the monastery, he must have been a hell guardian in a previous lifetime. He really likes those hell suttas. But notice that also that he presents the Four Noble Truths to Ubali when his mind is malleable, ready, unhindered, exultant, confident. Just the idea that, okay, I could have these sensual pleasures, but you know, my mind is higher than that. It's kind of a confidence that comes with that. Okay, then you're ready for the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths themselves, first, we talked all first about the definition of the first. The Buddha goes through a list of things that are stressful. Birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, despair, associating with the unbeloved, separation from the loved, not getting what is wanted is stressful. It's interesting when there's a sutta where Sariputta goes into more detailed analysis of this one, and not getting what is wanted is not getting to be, you know, once you were born, not getting not to age, not to be ill, not to die. There's no way you're going to get that, just through wanting. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. Are there any questions about those clinging aggregates? We haven't gone through the four types of clinging. There's sensuality clinging, i.e. clinging to fascination with, you know, fantasizing about sensual pleasures. There's habit and practice clinging, which is when you're stuck on certain ways of doing things and you can't imagine not doing them that way. Have I told you the story about Conrad Lorenz and his goose?
No.
Conrad Lorenz was an Austrian biologist, and he had a goose, pet goose, and the pet goose gave birth to a baby goose, gosling. And then the mother goose died. And so the gosling immediately imprinted on Conrad Lorenz and would follow around the garden throughout the summer. And as the summer was ending, Conrad Lorenz knew that he was going to start bringing the goose into the house for the winter. And so that one evening, the time when he would usually feed the goose, he didn't feed the goose. He just kind of walked into the house. And so the goose followed him into the house. And then it suddenly realized it was in this enclosed space. It had never been in an enclosed space before, and it freaked out. But saw there was a corridor that went through the house and ended in a window. Halfway down the corridor, there was a stairway that went up to the right, which is where Conrad Lawrence's apartment was on the next floor. And so Conrad Lawrence is heading up the stairways, but in the meantime, the goose goes straight to the window, realizes it can't get out, and then Conrad Lawrence calls to it, so it turns around and goes back up the stairs. From that point on, every time the goose went into the house, it went to the window first, then back up the stairs. And then as time went on, it would go shorter and shorter, shorter trips to the window, until finally it would get to that side of the stairway, shake its foot at the window, and go up the stairs. And then there was one evening when Conrad Lawrence comes back late from work, and the goose is really hungry. And so it comes zipping into the house and zipping up the stairs. And it gets halfway up the stairs, and it stops. It starts shaking all over. And then very methodically it goes down the stairs, back to the window, back up, back to the top. That's clinging to habits and practices. Listening to your inner goose. Okay, that's the second form of clinging. The third form of clinging is clinging to views. Specifically clinging to a view because you feel it makes you better than other people, or that simply the fact of holding to the view will guarantee some sort of result. You know, if you believe firmly enough in a certain religion, okay, they're going to take you to heaven. That kind of thing. And then finally, there's clinging to doctrines of the self. I mean, your theories about what you are and what the self is and what will happen to the self. Or whether there is a self. Just clinging to any answer to those questions. Is there a self? If so, what is it? Those are all different forms of clinging. And we cling to the five aggregates in different ways depending on those forms of clinging. Now, we don't cling necessarily to all five at any one time. Sometimes we cling to perceptions, sometimes we cling to feelings, sometimes we cling to fabrications, sometimes to any mixture of those. And as I said earlier, it's not just clinging that you identify yourself with the aggregate. Sometimes you feel that, okay, I have these aggregates in me, in which case you could have a cosmic sense of a self, but still that would be a form of clinging to the aggregates, saying these are my aggregates that are inside me. So those are the forms of clinging. Notice it's not just the aggregates that are stressful in the fourth, in this first noble truth, it's the clinging aggregates. There was a British PhD thesis that was written on the topic, and it was printed as a book, that the Buddha taught that the five aggregates are suffering. And then the author said, well, actually the five aggregates cover all experience, so maybe the word dukkha is not suffering, maybe it's just experience. And elaborated a huge theory around that. Missing the fact that, no, the Buddha didn't say the aggregates are suffering, he says it's the clinging aggregates. It's because we cling. That's why they're suffering. And the clinging is not necessary. That's the first noble truth. Second noble truth, the origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there, i.e. craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, craving for no becoming. Okay, we've talked about sensuality already. That's your fascination with thinking about sensual pleasures. Craving for becoming would be craving to take on an identity in a particular world of experience. And as I said earlier, that can be on a macro level, i.e. we're sitting in this world together and we're individuals within this world. But then we also have the cravings that go on in the mind. And those cravings that go on in the mind actually do create the larger becomings. Both in this lifetime, you get a desire and you start acting on it. That becomes the identity that you assume. So that desire for chocolate is not just this little you in there. It actually becomes what you're doing outside. And this craving for non-becoming, in other words, to destroy a particular becoming that has already gotten into and set into motion. And the reason that that's a cause for suffering is that in your desire to destroy that, you are going to take on the identity of a destroyer. So this presents a strategic problem. How do you get beyond becoming without destroying becoming? And the Buddha's answer is you look for the causes of becoming and you basically abandon those. So that whatever it would have been a potential becoming is just left as a potential and then it's dropped. So whatever becomings are already there, you let them carry themselves out, but you don't start new ones. So.
Yes. John, the four types of clinging you just mentioned, when the first three fetters fall away at stream enter, it kind of covers all four of those types of clinging, doesn't it? Let me make it into a question. Doesn't it?
No.
Self-view?
Okay. Doctrines of a self are dropped. Clinging to habits and practices are dropped. Clinging to sensuality doesn't get dropped until non-return. Clinging to views doesn't get dropped until arahantship. So there are different levels in which those kinds of clinging get dropped.
I thought perhaps because doubt drops.
But you still have views about things.
Right, okay, thank you.
Okay, the noble truth is cessation of stress is the remainderless fading, cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that craving. So in other words, the word fading here also means dispassion, can be translated as dispassion. If it's fading of any desire to keep it going, leads to the cessation. You renounce, relinquish, you let it go. That's interesting. You let the craving go. And you free it. You give the craving its freedom. In other words, you're not going to make it do your duties anymore. The word letting go here can also be translated as lack of nostalgia. In other words, it's not one of those things where you let go. It's not like an old romance that you start thinking about, and you know, you broke up a long time ago, and said, but there's still some bittersweet memories about that old romance, you know. Here, okay, there's no bittersweet memories, it's all bitter. You have no more desire ever again. But I wouldn't say bitter, but it's just no more nostalgia for it. The craving. June?
Ajahn, I'm just wondering about the term yoke. So it's going back to that, the earlier. So is the yoke has to do with our clinging?
Right. It's used often as a symbol for fetters that you are bound by. And remember that the fetter is from your own making. And the four yokes are also the same things as the four floods, i.e. sensuality, views, becoming, and ignorance. And so you get rest from that yoke, basically.
Okay. That's what it's referring to in this first one, the
right.
Rest from the yoke.
Rest from the yoke.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, on page 6, this is the noble way of practice, i.e. the Eightfold Path. And then these are the this is the vision that arises to the Buddha. In each case, he sees the noble truth of stress is to be comprehended, the noble truth of originatious stress is to be abandoned, the cessation is to be directly experienced, and the path to practice should be developed. And his awakening was when he also realized that all these tasks, had been completed. That's when he could let go. You know, there's a symbolism of the Dhamma wheel. It actually should have 12 spokes. Stands for the Four Noble Truths and the three levels of knowledge for each truth. In other words, knowing the truth, knowing the duty, and then knowing that duty has been completed. And that's what the Dharma wheel is. In the sutta, it's called setting the wheel of Dharma in motion. That's the wheel. Because back in the Buddha's time, legal texts or philosophical texts would go through, say, running two variables against each other in what we would call a table, where you'd go through the different permutations of the variables. They would call it a wheel, and they would just kind of go one, all around the circle of all the possible permutations. That's what they meant by a wheel. So the Dharma wheel is the wheel of the Four Noble Truths and the three levels of knowledge appropriate to the truths. And as I said, stop me at any point if you have any questions.
I'm just curious because so the teaching on dependent co-arising seems to be such a central teaching, and obviously the Four Noble Truths are such a central teaching. And in the teaching on co-arising, it seems like there's almost kind of pride of place given to ignorance as the problem. Mm-hmm. And in the Second Noble Truth, it's very clearly
craving.
Laid on craving. Mm-hmm. And can you kind of elucidate that to me? Okay. Why does it all collapse on craving if it has to be summarized?
Once the craving is there, there's got to be suffering. Up to that point, there's a choice. You can engage in these other activities and not necessarily suffer, but not necessarily have suffering in the Four Noble True sense of the word. But once you've got the craving, then there's going to be suffering. So this is one of the ways of undercutting it, would be to go see, well, what are some of these conditions prior to craving that I can cut so I don't have to get to the point of craving?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it can, like, once birth has taken place, then death becomes inevitable or suffering.
But you pull it back a little further. Once there's craving, there's inevitably going to be suffering.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go on to the ultimate level of the noble right view, which is right view beyond the Four Noble Truths. This is where Nanda Bindika goes to see the wanderers. As he was sitting, they said to him, "Tell us, householder, what views Gotama the contemplative has." "Venerable sirs, I don't know entirely what views the Blessed One has." Now this is Nanda Bindika, he's a stream enterer. But he says, "I don't know the Buddha's views." He knows what the Buddha taught, and he knows that, you know, that the end of suffering is true. But as to what other views the Buddha might have, he says, "I don't know." "So, very well, you don't know entirely what views the Gotama the contemplative has. Then tell us what views the monks have." "I don't even know entirely what views the monks have." "So, you don't know entirely what views Gotama the contemplative has, or even what the monks have. Then tell us what views you have." "It wouldn't be difficult for me to expound to you what views I have, but please let the Venerable Ones expound each in line with his view standpoint. And then it won't be difficult for me to expound to you what views I have." And so this is then the views get laid out. "The cosmos is eternal, only this is true, anything otherwise is worthless. The cosmos is not eternal, the cosmos is finite, infinite. The soul is the same thing as the body, the soul is one thing and the body another. After death, the Tathagata exists, doesn't exist, both does and doesn't exist, and neither nor does not exist. Only this is true, anything else is worthless." When this had been said, Ananda Bendiga, the householder, said to the wanderers, "As for the Venerable One who says the cosmos is eternal, only this is true, anything otherwise is worthless, this is the sort of view I have. His view arises from his own inappropriate attention or independence on the words of another. Now this view has been brought into being, is fabricated, willed, dependently co-arisen. Whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, will-dependent, core-arisen, that is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stressful. This venerable one thus adheres to that very stress, submits himself to that very stress. And this, and he does the same for the other view standpoints. And this has been said, the wanderer said to Ananda Bendika, okay, we've each and everyone expounded to you in line with our own view standpoints. Now tell us what views you have. Whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, will, dependent, coercion, that is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stressful. Whatever is stressful is not me, is not what I am, is not myself. This is the sort of view I have. So, householder, whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, will, dependent, coercion, that is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stressful. Thus you adhere to that very stress, submit yourself to that very stress. They're trying to catch him in his own words. He says, venerable sirs, what has been brought into being is fabricated, will, dependent, coercion, that is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stressful. Whatever is stressful is not me, is not what I am, is not myself. Having seen this well with right discernment as it has come to be, I also discern the higher escape from it as it has come to be. In other words, the escape is through that realization that this is not me, this is not what I am, this is not myself. So even the view itself is something you don't hold, you don't identify with. So this is why right view has the seeds for its own transcendence. You can apply the analysis to other views, and then you turn around and you apply it to it, so you can let go of it as well. When this has been said, this gets into stock phrases. The wanderers fell silent, abashed, sitting with their shoulders drooping, their heads down, brooding, at a loss for words. Then Ananda Bendika, seeing that the household wanderers were silent, etc., at a loss for words, got up and went to the Blessed One. Excuse me. As he was sitting there, he told the Blessed One the entirety of his discussion with the wanderers. The Blessed One said, well done, householder, well done. This is how you should periodically and righteously refute those foolish men. So then after another Bendika, he says, monks, even a monk who has long penetrated the Dharma with this Amidvenu would do well periodically and righteously to refute the wanderers of other sects in just the way the householder has done. So the Buddha is giving his approval to what Ananda Bendika said. So the point here is, as I said, that right view is special in that it teaches you to look at views and themselves as events. Most people, when they have a view, it's all about that out there. And they don't turn around and look at it. Well, what are you doing as you hold to that view? And this is a view that has you turn around and look at that. Well, this is what's involved in holding to a view. When is it useful to hold to a view? When do I let go? And when you see that there's going to be, it itself is now a cause of stress, you let it go. But as long as it's a useful tool, you hold on to it. This is an analogy that the Forest Johns like to use a lot. You're building a chair or a piece of a cabin or something. You're going to need your tools, and you hold on to your tools while you're working with them. But then when the cabin is done, you put them down. The question over here?
So if I'm lucky enough to notice anger arising without actually becoming angry, is non-becoming and non-self, like the sense of the anger isn't myself, are those related in some way? Or
The choice to identify with the anger would be becoming. The choice not to identify with anger, you see the potential is there and you don't follow it. And that would be the skillful way to approach that.
And this is related to like the concept of birth as well.
Mm-hmm.
So these all three.
Yeah. Thing is that if you do find yourself in a state of anger, this is a time to have a little craving for non-becoming. You see, I'll get to that point later when I get like let go of that one. But I need to get out of this right now.
Ajahn, you mentioned the 12 steps of the Four Noble Truths. So there was, I wonder if we could just speak to us about the three steps for each one. The first one was the duty, so no, that
knowing,
has to
knowing
be
the truth itself.
Comprehended.
Knowing the truth itself. Second one is knowing the duty.
Knowing the duty, the actions involved to
What you have to do with that particular. Yes. And then the third one is knowing you've completed the duty.
Okay.
You fully comprehended the stress, you fully abandoned the cause. You fully realize the cessation, and you fully develop the path. That's when he said, when he had that those three levels of knowledge for all 400 Patus, that's when he knew he was awakened.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, passage 12. By enlarged Gajayana, the Buddha's talking to a monk, this world is supported by or takes as its object a polarity, that of existence and non-existence. But when one sees the origination of the world, and the world here is just experience at the six senses, sight, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations, ideas, when it's seen the origination of the world with right discernment as it has come to be, non-existence with reference to the world does not occur to one. When one sees the cessation of the world with right discernment has come to be, existence with reference to the world does not occur to one. Now what he's talking about here is the fact if you're focused on the fact that things are arising and passing away right at the senses, the idea of the existence or non-existence of the world just doesn't occur to you. These terms don't occur to you. Because it is saying that it exists, well, you can obviously see these things falling away. To say that it doesn't exist, you see these things are obviously arising. So those terms don't apply. And this is important. If you're going to be letting go of your sense of self, one of the big fears is, well, I'm going to be letting go of something that exists. But if you're not even thinking in terms of existence or non-existence, then that fear doesn't arise. You're simply looking at, okay, this is just stress arising, stress passing away. And the question of, gee, if I let go of the stress, will I go out of existence? At that state of mind, that question doesn't occur. So you're trying to look at things in such a way that the categories of existence or existence really don't occur to you. That sounds kind of mystical, but it's not that all that mystical. It's just, you know what it's like. You're totally involved in, playing a piece of music or something. And a lot of things at that moment are not occurring to you because you're totally absorbed in what you're doing. So in this particular case, you're so totally absorbed in seeing events arising and passing away that the questions of the existence or non-existence of you or the world just doesn't occur to you at that point. You're just interested in the issue of their arising and passing away. And then seeing, okay, where is, and then goes on to this, says, by and large, this world is in bondage to attachments, clingings, and biases, but one such as this does not get involved with or cling to these attachments, clingings, fixations of awareness, biases, or obsessions, nor is he resolved on myself. In other words, those terms are just not occurring to the mind at that point. He has no uncertainty or doubt that when stress, when arising, is arising, that mere stress, when arising, is arising, stress, when passing away, is passing away. In other words, everything you see is just stress arising and passing away. Now, this is the mind at the verge of awakening. When everything, and then the terms of analysis based on what you were doing at that point are just stress arising, stress passing away. And the only duty you have there is just let it go, let it go. That's the ultimate level of right view. Questions? Yes.
Back into passage 11, Anathapindika, mm-hmm. He says, it wouldn't be difficult for me to expound to you the views that I have, but, please do it first. Mm-hmm. And then it still won't be difficult for me to explain my views.
Yeah.
So why did he need them to move first? He could have answered the question without having them to expound their views.
He wanted to put them in a trap.
Pardon?
He wanted to trap them.
Okay. That's what it looks like.
And also to show what was superior about his view.
Pardon?
And also to show what was superior about his view.
Okay.
Because he wanted them to look at the fact, not about the world out there, but mm-hmm. look, the fact that you're holding onto this view, what is the psychology behind this view?
Mm-hmm.
That's what he wanted them to turn around and look at. And to see that no matter how right your opinion may be, that the way you're holding on to is causing stress.
Trapping them.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you. I like it.
You can use that in your work. You know?
I will.
Because otherwise, if you'd just gone straight into that, they wouldn't have appreciated what was special about what he had to say. No way they'd be left brooding at a loss for words. So. Anything else? Now, this is a typical technique on the Buddha's part. There's, you know, that the four kinds of questions that he would answer. There's the questions that deserved a categorical answer, and the questions that deserved an analytical answer, where he redefined the terms. Questions that deserve cross-questioning, and then finally, questions that deserve to be put aside. The cross-questioning ones are the most interesting ones, next to the ones put aside. And they're interesting because the way the Buddha is approaching an argument with someone is he will, before giving the answer to a question, he will get them to discuss a particular analogy and commit themselves to making statements about the analogy. And then once they've committed themselves, then he will pounce.
He's looking for fuel.
There was a case where this prince comes to him, and the prince has been put up by the Jains. They say, we've got a great question for you to ask the Buddha. You ask this question, the Buddha will not be able to answer it, and you'll be famous for the person who stumped the Buddha. And the question is this, would the Buddha say anything unpleasant? And he said, if the Buddha says, no, he wouldn't say anything unpleasant. He said, well, you said some pretty unpleasant things about Devadatta, saying that Devadatta was a lick spittle and he was destined to hell. If he says to the Buddha, yes, he would say things were unpleasant, then you say, what's the difference between you and ordinary people? And so the Buddha starts out by saying, well, there's no categorical answer to that question. And the prince right then realizes, okay, the Buddha has not been trapped. But then the Buddha goes on and says, the prince had this baby son in his lap. And the commentary says he brought the baby son there in case that the discussion gets difficult. He could pinch the baby son would cry, and that would be the end of the discussion. But he says, you've got this baby son in your lap. Suppose he got something sharp in his mouth, what would you do? And the prince says, well, I'd get my finger into his mouth and pull it out, whatever it was, and even if it meant drawing a little blood, because otherwise if he swallows it, it's going to be even worse. And the Buddha says, okay, in the same way, there are times when. And then the Buddha goes through his analysis of when he would say things that are unskillful, unpleasant. But he said, would always have to be true, it would always have to be beneficial, and then the question of whether it's the right time to say something pleasing or unpleasing, that would depend on circumstances. So there are times when, and the analogy, of course, is pulling the sharp object out, even if it means drawing blood. You say unpleasing things because the person needs that kind of treatment. Then the prince says, do you have these answers prepared ahead of time? Or does they just occur to you on the spot? And then the Buddha says, well, how about you? Do you know anything about chariots? And it turns out that the prince is well known for, it's like saying, what do you know about cars? You know, and then the prince, I really know cars inside and out. And so do you go around asking yourself, well, if somebody asks me about this part of the car, what will I say? If somebody asks me about that part of the car, what will I say? And the prince says, no, I know cars, chariots so well, I can answer right off the spot. Now he's gotten the prince to actually, he's been praising the prince gets to praise himself. And so he's willing to listen to what the Buddha has to say. He says, in the same way, I know the Dharma well enough, I don't have to think about it ahead of time. Now there are other cases, and in this case they're kind of playing along, he's playing along, feeding the vanity of the prince to get the prince on his side. There are other times where he gets the person to commit to an analogy. Like the Buddhist, there's one guy who claims that, everybody knows that the five aggregates are the self. And the Buddha says, I'll give you an analogy. Suppose, can I ask you, does the king of this particular country have the right to impose laws and to capture criminals? He says, yes, the king does, because he owns the country, it's basically his, he can apply any laws he wants to. That's what it means to be in control. And the Buddha says, do you have that same control over your body? And the guy realizes he's been caught. He's already committed that ownership means control. And the lack of control means no ownership. So that's how you deal with arguments. You get the other side to commit.
I would never enter a debate with a trained monk.
Any other questions?
Yes, just going back to the graduated, the concept of graduated talk and the Buddha giving the graduated talk on page 5, mm-hmm. from mundane to transcendent right view. Just a straightforward question. If this is a way to teach the Four Noble Truths that you have to prepare the listener, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. then what can we conclude about the way it's taught these days?
We got a lot of people hearing about it who are not prepared. That's not nearly as effective.
Is it harmful? Is it potentially harmful?
I mean, it'll just kind of go past people. There's no preventing. I mean, it's out there already. And it's just some people say, well, I don't really see how this is relevant to me or why this is important. Or why are they not 5 Noble Truths? I like the number 5 better than 4. But to get the full effect, I mean, your mind has to prepare to be to see, okay, renunciation is a good thing. I mean, that's the immediate prerequisite. And then how you get the mind to that state is going to vary from person to person. Because there are cases where the Buddha just started right in with the 4 Noble Truths. I guess he felt the person was ready. In other cases, you say, okay, let's lay the framework, let's lay the groundwork first. Questions? Okay, let's move on to right resolve. Just want to make a few points first. As we said already, there is mundane and transcendent right resolve. Mundane right resolve is resolve for renunciation, for non-ill will, and for harmlessness. Transcendent is basically getting the mind into the first jhana. And the progression from mundane to noble or transcendent right resolve is shown in Majjhima 19, where the Buddha talks about his own practice. Where he says there came a point where he decided to divide his thoughts into two sorts. And the thoughts that were imbued with sensuality, ill will, and harmfulness he put on one side. And the ones that were imbued with renunciation, non-ill will, and harmlessness he put on another side. And as for the first, he said if those thoughts came into his mind, he would try to hold them in check. Whereas the second ones came in, it was okay to let the mind continue thinking those directions. He gives the analogy of a cowherd. Now, during the rainy season, when the rice is growing, the cowherd has to make sure that the cows don't get into the rice. You read the records of colonial Sri Lanka, and the colonial administrators were dealing constantly with issues of somebody's cows gets into somebody's rice. It's driving the administrators up the wall. And so the duty of the cowherd is to make sure they don't get in the rice. So the cows have to be checked and beaten and everything, make sure they don't get into the rice fields. That's an analogy for the first kind of thoughts, i.e. the unskillful thoughts. Skillful thoughts, he said, it's like the cowherd during the dry season. The rice has been harvested, stored. The cows can go anywhere they want. They're not going to be getting into trouble. All you have to remember is that there are cows out there someplace. And so in the same way, you're conscious of the fact that the mind is thinking, but you don't have to keep so much control or place so many limitations on the thoughts because they're going in a skillful direction. However, he says, you realize if you think a long time, even if it's skillful thoughts, the mind gets tired. And so to prevent the mind from getting tired, you incline it to get into concentration. So that's how you go from mundane right resolve to transcendent right resolve. Get the mind into the first jhana. Now, right resolve gets some training from discernment in the sense that, in terms of renunciation, it gets a sense of which pleasures lead to unskillful qualities. In other words, you don't have to give up all sensory pleasures. It's just you realize that there are certain pleasures that the activities that would lead up to the pleasure would be unskillful, or indulging that particular pleasure would lead to unskillful states of mind. Those are the pleasures you've got to keep under control. As far as developing goodwill and compassion, which are the same thing as non-ill will and harmlessness, you learn how to view these mind states in line with karma. One, the fact that they themselves are determinations. Goodwill and compassion are not the innate quality of the mind. They are potentials that are in the mind, but their opposites are also potentials in the mind as well. We have both within us. So it's not a matter of just letting your innate attention, innate nature just kind of show itself. These are things you have to make as a determination. I am determined to have goodwill for everybody, even the people I hear about on the media that I don't like. Got to have goodwill. Okay. And you have to make up your mind. That's something you have to make up your mind for. So in other words, you see that they are fabricated states, and that you can imply the three different kinds of fabrication involved in creating them, and learn how to breathe in a way that makes you more inclined to want to feel goodwill. How to think to yourself, saying, no matter what that person is doing, it's good for me to have goodwill for that person. And then the feelings and perceptions that you hold in mind. The Buddha says, if you see that somebody else is misbehaving, but they have some good qualities, think of it as, you find a piece of cloth on the road, you need cloth, but there's a dirty part of the cloth, so you learn how to separate the dirty part from the part that you need, and then you take only the good part. It's an analogy to hold in mind. If somebody has no good qualities whatsoever, you can't see a single good thing about them, you've got to have pity for them. It's in the same way that you see somebody lying on the road in the middle of a desert, sick, without anybody to help them. You've got to feel sorry for this person, because the person who has no good qualities, they're just really making life, their future, really miserable. So those are some of the mental fabrications that you would hold in mind as you try to create a state of goodwill. Because you remember that you're doing the practice of goodwill and compassion not because other people deserve your goodwill and compassion, but you need your own goodwill and compassion to make sure that you don't behave in unskillful ways around other people. It's primarily for your own good. So that's how you apply right view to just the process of giving rise to goodwill, or how karma applies to that. But it also applies to the content. You look at happiness in line with karma, and you realize, basically, when you say, may all beings be happy, you're basically saying, may all beings understand the causes for happiness and act on them. In other words, people are not going to be happy just because you wish them goodwill. They've got to do the things that will lead to happiness. This is what you're hoping for. And when you think about the goodwill in those terms, then it's a lot easier to think about it, to extend it to difficult people, because you're basically hoping, may this person change his or her ways. Also, it's important to realize that the teaching on karma helps with goodwill, and that you see the complexity of a person's karmic field. You cannot see all of a person's past karmic potentials. I mean, there's a belief somehow that what you see right now is a person's current running karma balance. It's all their past karma, good and bad, kind of added and subtracted, and what you've got in the present moment is the current running balance. And you have to realize each person is a lot more complex than that. They have lots of good actions and lots of bad actions in their karma field. And so you don't know which seeds are ready to sprout. So just because someone is suffering right now doesn't mean, well, this person deserves to continue suffering or will have to continue suffering. They may have the potential that, if you get the right words to them or the right circumstances happen, their karma will turn, or the new good karma will have a chance to show. Which means that it is worthwhile to try to help people. I mean, some people interpret karma as saying, well, there's this person is suffering, they deserve to suffer, and there's nothing I can do, and you kind of leave them behind. That's not good karma in and of itself, thinking that thought. You have to say, maybe this person has the potential, you try to help. It's only after you try two or three times and nothing's happening, you say, well, maybe not yet. And finally, as I said earlier, with regard to your motivation to do this, you don't do this because other beings deserve your goodwill or that they're one with you or innately good. It's because you need to protect your motivation when interacting with them so you don't do anything unskillful. This is why we're doing extending thoughts of goodwill, is to protect our motivation in dealing with other people. Now, in engaging in right resolve, you actually go back, turn around, and teach some lessons to right view. in the movement from mundane to noble right resolve, you learn to appreciate the value of stillness of mind. You learn to appreciate concentration as a good rest for the mind. And you also understand the need of happiness that comes from strong concentration. If you want to really want to get beyond sensuality and ill will, the Buddha says, if you don't have that pleasure, the pleasure of concentration, then no matter how much you understand the drawbacks of sensuality, no matter how you understand the drawbacks of ill will, you'll keep going back for the pleasure that comes from those things. You need to provide the mind with an alternative pleasure so that it's willing to let go of those, the pleasure of sensuality and the pleasure of ill will. And then in developing goodwill and compassion, you begin to understand the need for equanimity, in the sense that if you have lots of goodwill for people, but they just won't change their ways and that they're just going to continue to suffer, you have to say, okay, I have to let that person go for the time being, or that let that particular issue go for the time being so I can focus my energies on areas that would be more effective. So teaching the mind to appreciate, okay, equanimity, it would be a good skill to have. So that is also good for your right view. Any questions on any of those issues? Yes.
It's the mic. That discernment of like with the idea of helping when there is it.
We want to get it on in order to get it recorded.
Oh, okay.
The recording.
Oh, I see.
It's
okay.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Wow. The idea of helping, so what really helps, how you understand that, how you know what will help, mm-hmm. and then when is it time to walk away, these are such refined, subtle...
There's no clear-cut answer for that one. It's going to be an individual matter as to when you've decided, okay, I've given everything I can to this person.
To what point you decide I can't give any more, or
right.
What is the cost, or what
the cost, or just you know, if it's you know, we call it a karmic sink. All this good karma seems to be going in, and nothing's happening. And
okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Still a mystery. Yeah. But the Buddha does. I mean, the fact that you're developing more mindfulness and alertness as other parts of the path would give you a clue to start how to read these things more effectively. This is also one of the reasons why the Buddha has, like within the monkhood, you have to stay with your teacher for 5 years, because part of that is seeing the teacher interact with other people and noticing the point where the teacher just kind of lets some things go. And you'll see it with different people, it seems to be different points, but after a while you begin to get kind of an intuitive sense. Anything else?
So the strings of sensuality, and then so there's these you know, these sensations, you know, enticing, all that kind of thing. So but it seems like there could be a you know, you could get yourself in trouble, couldn't you? It sounds like you could there's a point where you got to know if you are being enticed or if your mind is clinging or whatever.
This is one of the areas why the Buddha says he wants someone who's truthful and honest to practice the path. When you begin to realize, okay, my indulging in this is really not helping. And that the indulgence is actually bad for me. And a lot of it has to do with, well, to what extent are you fantasizing about it beforehand and fantasizing about it afterwards? Can you still indulge with that pleasure without the fantasizing? Because you find that a lot of, if you don't allow yourself to fantasize about the pleasure, then the pleasure loses a lot of its allure. John Lee's example is of a dog chewing on a bone, and all it's tasting is its saliva. And once you get honest about yourself, okay, This is a saliva passion. I don't know.
Okay, good. So you look at it before and afterwards, and you can judge for yourself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Mike over here. Right there.
I'm really interested to know how would one develop the pleasures of concentration? How would one start?
Start with thoughts of goodwill. Spread thoughts of goodwill to yourself and other beings. Focus on your breath, i.e. what we're doing this morning. And if you find that you can get sensitive to what kind of breathing really does feel good, and you can learn how to say, that's what I just need is a good breath break for a while, and learn how to allow the breathing to refresh the whole body. As you get more sensitive to the breath energies in the body, you get a sense of, okay, what does my body need right now, and how you can provide it. That's how you work on the pleasure of concentration. Let's look at these readings on Right Resolve, and then we'll break for the day. Here the Buddha is making the distinction in reading number 13 between the strings of sensuality, and the word strings here is like the strings on a guitar. Okay. Start with forms, sounds, aromas, flavors, tactile sensations, agreeable, pleasing, charming, endearing, fostering desire, enticing. He says, but these are not sensuality. These are called strings of sensuality in the discipline of the noble ones. And what is sensuality? The passion for your resolves. Not the beautiful sensual pleasures found in the world. It's the passion for your resolves, i.e. the thinking and the planning and the fantasizing around these things. You can get pretty passionate about your fantasies. He says, the beauties remain as they are in the world, while the wise in this regard subdue their desire. In other words, you see that the things are beautiful, they are beautiful, but you don't have that desire for or need for them anymore. That's the state that you're trying to get into. This is why I say, for example, Mahakasapa, who was one of the sternest of the Buddha's Arahant's disciples, wrote some of the nicest wilderness poetry in the Pali Canon, appreciating the beauties of wild nature. So there's no desire there, but there's an appreciation that these things are beautiful and it's a good place to be. It's a harmless pleasure. So the problem is not the pleasures, the problem is your mind's fascination with or attachment to thinking about them and planning for them. Passage 14, non-ill will. This is one of the, you know, you hear about having metta phrases. This is one the Buddha recommends. You bear no ill will and you're not corrupt in the resolves of your heart. You think, may these beings be free from animosity, free from oppression, free from trouble, and may they look after themselves with ease. That's the interesting point. May they be able to take care of themselves. Otherwise, you're not promising, I'll be there for them. So may they be there for themselves. May they not need me. May they be self-competent, self-sufficient. In other words, this gets back to, may they create the causes for happiness. We're not engaging in magical thinking here. They're saying, may they, these people, create the causes for happiness in their actions. And I'll be willing to support them in any way that's helpful in that direction. But may they master their own actions. That's what it means to have goodwill for someone. Any last questions before we break?
And I guess, Ajahn, at the same time, you want them to become aware of the cause of their suffering. Sometimes it's painful to see people who are suffering, and you can't really tell them, but
right. Mm-hmm.
They can't see the cause of their suffering right in front of their face.
Right. And that's when you have to have equanimity for the time being. But if there is some way that you can help, you're happy to help. Mike, over here.
Is it possible to wish someone well, that they learn the causes of their suffering and so on, and in the same breath feel animosity towards them?
Animosity is not the right word. You can feel dislike.
Dislike, okay. Yeah,
okay. You're allowed to not like the person.
So your heart doesn't have to be in it.
No. Well, it doesn't have to be so open and tender and all those other adjectives that you hear. In this case, it would kind of be more more intellectual goodwill. But remember, you're doing this so that if you ever have to have an interaction with that person, you're not going to be tempted to do a little sniping.
But if you dislike them, if it's incomplete, if there's some karmic sort of action in there that is...
Well, there are people doing awful things. You can't like the awful things that they're doing, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the Buddha never says you have to like everybody you feel goodwill for. Here it's important to make a distinction. The word goodwill, metta, is translated as loving kindness. And then it gets all involved in definitions of real love and that kind of stuff. Pali has another word for love, which is bhema, like bhema children. And the Buddha says that is not an immeasurable quality. Because when you have love for X, you know, suppose somebody does something really nasty to X, you're not going to love that other person. Love is not something that can be universal. Because there are going to be people mistreating the people you love. And he says there's actually hatred that comes from love. There's love that comes from hatred. In other words, suppose you hate Eric, and then there's somebody else who does something really nasty to Eric. You're going to really like that person who does something nasty. So love, like and dislike are not reliable qualities. And they're distinct from goodwill. So in some cases where you feel love for somebody and you feel goodwill for someone, there's much of a heart, more of a heart quality that goes into it. And there are other people that are really doing horrible things, but you say, I wish this person would change his ways. And the question is, do I want that person to see that person suffer before he changes his ways? And part of you will say, yes, that would give me some satisfaction. You say, no, I can't go with that. It doesn't accomplish anything. So trying to sort of visualize that person suddenly seeing the light and changing his or her ways. Years back, there was a woman I knew. Her basic training was in Tibetan Buddhism. But as she told me, when she wanted practical advice, she came to Theravada monks. You know. And she was having problems with her landlord. The landlord was going to sell the property, and he wanted all the people who were renting the property to falsify the amount that they were giving in rent so the landlord could sell it for a higher price. And he was going to each tenant separately. And she said, I've been trying to have goodwill for this person. I'm trying to imagine him with all the girlfriends he wants and all the houses and swimming pools. He says, no, that's not goodwill. Try to see him acting in a skillful way, okay? And then band together with the other tenants in the meantime and say, okay, we're not going to give in as a group. So visualize him being skillful. Visualize this other person being skillful. And say, I really would like to see that. That's goodwill. Okay. Anything else? Okay, should we break there? Then tomorrow we start with right speech.